Welcome to the 13th edition of Renewing Our Spirit Conference. It's hard to believe we're celebrating our bar mitzvah already. We are proud and we share in the joy with everybody from our early baby steps. We are now internationally recognized for our creative programming, our innovative work, our nuance, our openness, and our willingness to talk about any and all subjects of importance to our community. At last count, there were over 77,800 people who are part of the Torah in Motion international community. We're growing at a clip of about almost 20 people a week, 1,000 people a year. We're in 32 countries. The last time I checked, people getting our emails, are downloading our MP3s. We've expanded our programming outside of Toronto, Israel, University of Pennsylvania, New York, and of course our trips all over our journeys in Jewish history. And we have a lot to be happy and to I'm proud of. Like all bar mitzvah boys, we have to thank all the people who helped us to reach our milestone. So we'll start this evening on the Krauss family, who have sponsored this program every year since year one. They unfortunately had to be out of town, but I want to thank Larry and Sarah and the whole family for their ongoing support of the work we do. We want to thank the many, many institutions who are hosting our program, Shir Shamai, many other shuls and schools throughout Toronto. And of course, we want to thank you, our supporters, our donors, the people who come to our programs, the people who write us comments and feedback. And we want to thank the over 300 speakers who have graced us. And I think it's really, we're extremely proud. I don't know of any other organization that really has the quality that many other wonderful organizations. I don't mean to, but we're very proud of the quality of the speakers we've had, and I think I don't think for sure in Toronto we've brought to the city, I think, a deep understanding, a sophistication, and we look forward to, that's only our beginning. When you become a bar mitzvah, it's only the beginning. So we look forward to many, many years. This week's Parsha, Vayeshev. So Rashi already quotes that Yaakov Avinu wanted to rest and to sit on his laurels. And that's why the whole story of Yosef began. God said, there's no rest for the righteous in this world. And we're always looking for new opportunities, new challenges, and new ways to help and to bring a breadth and depth to Judaism, to the community. And we look forward to your ongoing support, your comments and suggestions, and I want to thank you and thank all of us. Yes, I'll thank now, and I'll turn over the microphone to our partner, Elliot, Dr. Malamud, for his creativity, and really so much of the programming is through his ingenuity, and I don't know anybody who moderates programs with a level of depth and sophistication. So I'm going to turn over the program. He made Aliyah last year to fulfill a lifelong dream, and so he now has his foot in two countries, on Vakasha, and we're looking forward to a fascinating evening, a day-long program all day. We really have, I think, some wonderful speakers and wonderful topics. We look forward to seeing you in the morning and throughout the day, and Shavua Tov. Thank you very much.
Good evening, I'm Dr. Elliot Malamud. Just war theory is a doctrine of military ethics which sets criteria to ensure war is morally justifiable. The criteria are usually split into two groups: the right to go to war, jus ad bellum, and the right conduct in the war, jus in bello. The first concerns the morality of going to war, and the second concerns moral conduct within the war. What is right conduct in a war? Ideas like distinguishing between combatants and non-combatants, or not causing disproportionate harm to innocents, and the military necessity of carrying out acts often crop up in discussions about the ethics of war. But it's precisely these categories that have become increasingly slippery in the advent of contemporary conflict, as the domain switches from war between conventional armies to more asymmetrical conflicts between countries and often semi-fugitive and terrorist-type entities. So we brought together a distinguished group of scholars tonight to tackle these thorny but grave problems, and it's my pleasure to introduce them to you. To my immediate left, Professor Asa Kosher is the Laura Schwartz Kipp Professor Emeritus of Professional Ethics and Philosophy of Practice and Professor Emeritus of Philosophy at Tel Aviv University. His research covers a broad range of topics in philosophy and ethics. Professor Kosher is the author of the Israel Defense Forces Code of Ethics, which is published by the Israeli Ministry of Defense, and he's worked with others on the Code of Ethics of the Knesset, still work to be done there, and the Code of Ethics of the Ministers. And it's actually because of Professor Kosher, I want to thank him, that he introduced me to Dr. Daniel Lagasse-Roy, who is a researcher in military ethics and leadership at the Canadian Forces Leadership Institute. And Dr. Roy currently teaches military professionalism and ethics at the Royal Military College of Canada in Kingston, Ontario. His recent publications include Ethics in the Canadian Forces, Making Tough Choices, and The War on Terror, Ethical Considerations. Rabbi Aryeh Klapper is Dean of the Center for Modern Torah Leadership and a member of the Boston Beit Din. He previously served as the Orthodox Advisor and Associate Director for Education at Harvard Hillel, as the Talmud Curriculum Chair at Maimonides High School, and as Instructor of Rabbinics and Medical Ethics at Gann Academy. He has published in Tradition, Me'orot, Dinei Yisrael, and other journals, and has presented at numerous conferences. Please welcome our speakers. I'd like to explore with you, to begin, the line between a just war and an unethical military campaign, and how human rights figure in the midst of armed conflict. In other words, what kind of war, for instance, Israel and other Western countries are morally permitted to fight, and what role innocent civilians play in our calculation of military strategy. So let me flesh this out for just a minute. In 2006, Professor Michael Walzer, who we had with us about 5 years ago, wrote the following about Hezbollah. Quote, Israel is now at war with an enemy whose hostility is extreme, explicit, unrestrained, and driven by an ideology of religious hatred, unquote. Yet, Professor Walzer argued that despite the fact that civilian shields are cruel and immoral ways of fighting, there cannot be any direct attack on civilians, he meant by Israel, even if the enemy doesn't believe in the existence of civilians. And he was actually critical of Professor Kosher and Amos Yodlin's claim that Israeli soldiers take precedence over the safety of the other side's civilians. He said that such an idea is wrong and dangerous and erodes the distinction between combatants and non-combatants. So let's use this as a background and let's discuss the following. If enemies like Hamas or ISIS have already eroded the distinction between combatant and non-combatant in so many ways, should Israel and the West have to go to such efforts to guard that distinction? In a practical case, let's say, if a hospital or a school is appropriated by Hamas as a base to attack Israel, then despite the fact that there are innocent civilians stuck or forced to remain inside these places, admittedly through no fault of their own, should Israel refrain from striking that house or that school? I'm going to begin with Professor Kosher and then ask everybody to comment.
Thank you for your interesting question. It's easier asked than answered. I mean, one has to start with the deep values that underlie a policy or a doctrine that provides us with answers to this question. And you ask yourself whether we should go on respecting the distinction between combatants and non-combatants, one, while our enemies disregard it totally and intentionally, deliberately, strategically. The simple answer is yes, because we are not going to adjust our standards to the standards of our enemy. If our enemy is extremely immoral, this means sometimes that we will resort to other means of fighting it. But we are not going to change our values. We're not going to revise our norms just because our enemy is the way it is. We are going to act on our principles, on our basic principles. Be the enemy whoever it is, and acting as it prefers to act. And it pertains to every state and every organization. It pertains to the Hamas, to the Hezbollah, to the ISIS, in case we get engaged with them, with Syria, with everyone. Now, what are the fundamental principles, very briefly put? First of all, we are a democracy. And as a democracy, we ought to respect human dignity. We ought to be sensitive to what we do to human beings. And we ought to be very careful in our behavior when our behavior has results, and sometimes extreme results, with respect to the life and well-being and health of a certain person. That's a democracy. A Bill of Rights expresses it in internal affairs, and principles of just war express it externally. Now, having said that, now what does it mean in terms of war, peace and war? First of all, it means that we ought to prefer peace over war. Peace is always preferable over war. We must pursue peace. If we can reach an agreement with enemies and avoid involving our troops in a war where we suffer casualties and the enemy suffers collateral damage, then we should nurture the atmosphere of peace. We should pursue peace. Bakesh shalom v'rodfeo. Okay, it's a synagogue, so let me quote Psalms. Okay, Bakesh shalom v'rodfeo. Now, sometimes shalom is impossible, right? If the enemy attacks you, then there is no peace, no shalom. So you have to fight. Now, where you have to fight, the basic principle is the basic moral principle, which every democracy adheres to, is alleviate the calamities of war. Okay, a war involves death, and a war involves destruction. War is a horrible phenomenon, but sometimes it takes place. And there is no choice but to take part in it. When we do take part in it, because there is a war, then we ought to alleviate the calamities of war. Let war have awful results, but let us try to do our best in order to minimize them. Now, for that sake, just war doctrine, which is an ancient one, a very old one at least, has come up with two principles that are of importance. They are, I'll put them very briefly and very crudely. I mean, there are numerous refinements. But, roughly speaking, first of all, there is the principle of distinction. Okay, there are combatants and non-combatants. How are we going to alleviate the calamities of war? Here is one example. Let's leave the civilians of all parties in war aside. Okay? We are not going to attack your civilians. You're not going to attack our civilians. So we spared the life of the civilians. So we alleviated the calamities of war. So the distinction between combatants and non-combatants is an expression, is a practical expression of that idea, and it's an old principle, and we would like to adhere to it. We intend to act on it constantly. Now, indeed, Michael Walzer, who is a friend of mine, though we don't agree, we are in a strong conflict concerning one point, concerning a certain point. I agree that we should not intentionally air raid or shell civilians as such. If you have a group of civilians, that is what you see when you look at them. We shouldn't raid them, right? Civilians as such should not be raided. But he's mistaken when he tells us that we shouldn't attack civilians while we speak about human shields. We don't speak about civilians. We speak about terrorists who are shielded by civilians. So the persons who are attacked under such circumstances is not the civilians. They are the terrorists. And the civilians who are there, since they haven't left, are also about, at least some of them, about to get hurt. But we don't intend to kill them as a civilians. If there were just civilians there, we wouldn't detect them. Now there is another principle, I'll return to it briefly in a moment. There is another, the second principle is proportionality. Now, the whole world speaks about proportionality. From the Secretary General of the United Nations to the last journalist in some newspapers in Israel. Okay. They are all wrong. They don't understand proportionality. Usually, they think that proportionality has to do, for example, with the pictures of dead civilians. Okay, there is nothing more horrible than the picture of a dead child who was killed in a war. I agree. But that doesn't mean anything with respect to proportionality. Okay. Now, you compare the casualties on both sides. Okay, after the war, there were a certain number of casualties here, another number of casualties there. Difference in order of magnitude doesn't have anything to do with proportionality. Proportionality is the following idea, and it is expressed both in domestic law and in international law. The idea is compare the military advantage of the activity you plan or you are about to carry out with the collateral damage you expect to cause. Okay, compare the military advantage to the collateral damage. According to international law, according to the ordered international law, it's a consideration to be made by the commander, not by the politician or the lawyer or the journalist, by the commander. Because the commander has the best information about what is the military advantage he intends to gain from the activity and the best information about expected collateral damage.
Let me just pause. Are you saying that the equation is how much gain will I get militarily versus how much damage and loss will be caused? In other words, it's not worth the gain, the loss in terms of collateral damage.
Right. Okay. This is what you have to compare. Now, a minute after a Israeli tank shot a shell, then the Secretary General of the United Nations says it was excessive force. It was disproportional. Now, how does he know? How does he know? I mean, does he know what the intention was? Does he know what the military plan was? How does he know what the ends of this certain active action, military action was? How does he know what was the expected collateral damage? He knows nothing about it. He knows nothing about it. So it's just an expression of dissatisfaction with a very phenomenon of military activities. And I agree that if war is last resort. If there is a better way of solving your problems, then don't shoot. But if you are constantly attacked, then one cannot seriously blame you for defending yourself by the very fact that you're shooting. I mean, shooting can be disproportional, but the very resort to military force is not disproportional. Now let me conclude by mentioning ways in which Israel tries to minimize collateral damage. And I think that on this level, Israel is the best. I mean, I don't endorse the saying that IDF is the most moral military force in the world. I'm not using this expression. But on trying to minimize collateral damage, the IDF is the best. And evidence could be brought from the General Dempsey, who is the head of the Joint Chiefs of American Forces, who has a few days ago said that nobody does it better than Israel, and nobody does it even on a par with Israel. So let me give you just three brief examples. First of all, when we carry out a targeted killing operation, targeted killing means that there is a certain person, we cannot capture him, we ought to kill him in order to defend ourselves, so we plan an operation of targeted killing. Now, before targeted killing operation takes place, then there is a unit in the Air Force called Operation Research. And what they do is to take into account, computationally, it's done on computers, all the different ways of carrying out such a mission. You can use a plane, you can use bombs, you can use rockets or missiles or helicopters. The CIA uses, and the American military use drones. Israel never admitted using drones. And so there are different methods of doing it. and different parts of the day and different angles and different, I mean, there are all variety of parameters. And their duty is to find the best way. Now, what is the best way? Very high probability of hitting the terrorist and the lowest possible probability of causing collateral damage, minimizing collateral damage. Therefore, we kill when we carry out operation targeted killing, we kill very few neighbors. The proportion between the number of neighbors and the number of terrorists is, it's a classified number, but I can tell you that more than a difference in an order of magnitude. Whereas for the rest of the world, it's the other way around. Secondly, let me mention the so-called Squadron 100. Okay, there is a squadron of light planes. If during an operation like a protective edge, assume there is a helicopter on the way to Gaza to hit a certain site, a certain military target, then there is a light plane there that looks at the circumstances. I mean, the pilot. There are all kinds of other means of doing it, by all kinds of other so-called visant intelligence means, but there is a pilot there, not far from the place, who is allowed to abort the mission. If he knows what the mission is, and he knows what is expected in terms of the presence of civilians there, and he can watch the circumstances and say the situation has changed, the mission is aborted. You know how many missions have been aborted during protective edge? I mean, nobody is going to guess the percentage because it's so high. It's 20%. So 20% of the missions were aborted in order to minimize collateral damage. Okay. So in the third example I'd like to give is, okay, every battalion commander, every lieutenant colonel, every battalion commander has a so-called a population officer, which is an officer whose job in the staff of the battalion commander is to know the whereabouts of the civil population around the target. So there is a person who gives the information constantly. This is his sole job. Finally, I'd like to mention the method of warning. And Israel does warning more than anybody else. I mean, usually what you want to do is to separate between the combatants and non-combatants, okay? Separate between the terrorists and their neighbors. But the terrorists stick to their neighbors because that's their strategy. And that's their immoral way of acting. So you cannot remove the terrorists from the neighbors. So what you're trying to do is to remove the neighbors from the terrorists. So you warn them. You warn them by distributing leaflets. That was done already during Second World War, but it's still effective. Then you break into their television program and radio program and make announcements, Israeli announcements, to warn them. That also was done during World War II, but it's still effective. Then we make phone calls. Nobody had done it before. We did it in Operation Cast Lead. We make hundreds of thousands of phone calls. It's indeed not operators, it's a computer, it's a recorded message. But it's a recorded message that the phone rings at a certain home, the cellular phone or the regular phone. And the recorded message warns the person, because he lives in this neighborhood, that he should leave for a while because this has become a war zone. It's a dangerous place. Finally, there are additional means of warning, but I'd like to mention the knock on the roof. The knock on the roof is, it's a sort of ammunition. It's non-lethal. It's not explosive, but it's very noisy. And it knocks on the roof of a house that is going to be the area, the arena of military activity. It's the last warning. It still gives time to the people to evacuate the house. It's not seconds before the operation takes place. They can leave the house. And then if they leave the house, they're not going to be harmed. So now let's return in conclusion for what you said about Michael Walzer. I mean, Michael Walzer thinks that in case we made all those warnings and perhaps some civilians still remained with the terrorists, then we should jeopardize our troops and send them in so that they will look for those remaining civilians. They are endangering themselves because this place is full of terrorists. This is because we are interested in it. So we ought to jeopardize our troops in order to look for someone who stayed at home because he is afraid about the carpets if he leaves his home. Okay, so we are saying no way. No way are we going to endanger our troops after the neighbors have been warned again and again and again and again and again, just because someone is still there because he's afraid for his property.
Thank you. So I want to follow up on something you said and direct it to you, Professor Lagasse-Roy and Rabbi Clapper. You talked about alleviating calamities. And I'm curious because I think it's instructive to recall statements by two of the towering figures of World War II. So four-star General George S. Patton once said, "There's only one tactical principle which is not subject to change. It is to use the means at hand to inflict the maximum amount of wound, death, and destruction on the enemy in the minimum amount of time." And Douglas MacArthur said, "It's fatal to enter a war without the will to win it." But in recent conflicts, we see sort of more ambiguous language used and goals presented. So I'll give you a couple of examples. I'm curious about how we wage wars now. U.S. President Obama announced in May a timeline for American military withdrawal from Afghanistan. By the end of 2016, the only American military presence left will be a contingent guarding the embassy in Kabul. And the withdrawal schedule seems to have been drawn up. It was forged based on a desired peace deal with the Taliban. And this seems to be an about-face from prior U.S. policy, which had stated the Taliban gave al-Qaeda safe haven, and thus defeating the Taliban was a priority. In any case, even Prime Minister Netanyahu, in opposition, called for the overthrow of Hamas, clearly did not have that goal this past summer. So I'm wondering, I want to ask you, do we wage wars differently now? Do we fight to win? Or has there been a fundamental shift in our thinking about conflict? In other words, has our thinking changed because the nature of war has changed, that the opponent is no longer this conventional army, but kind of shadowy terrorists who hide behind civilians? In other words, are there new rules of war now?
Do we fight to win? I think we fight to win different objectives, I think. Not the way it was in the past when we were to war, when we went to war, okay? When we were facing a state against a state. This is what we have to take into consideration. And I think Dr. Mentioned that. The question of organization that are using terror as a tactic, okay, is completely different than a state who using, as you mentioned, just war theory and applying it and following it and declaring war against another state.
So you're saying we cannot fight them the same way that England fought Germany. We have to fight them differently.
Yes, fight differently.
Fight them differently means fight them without necessarily wanting to win or having to win or complete destruction.
I think we would love to have complete destruction. We would love that. And if there was a cure for that, and I would say a magic word, and I think it would be nice to know it. Okay. However, I think we are not, we cannot be naive in pretending that they are organization, as I said, and I prefer to say organization that are using terrorist tactics you know, because this is what we fight, okay? Because we might armies in the world, even in the past, use a bit of terrorism in the way they were doing business, okay? And that's why I'm saying that organization using this tactic. However, what we have to maybe learn better is to know how to understand their way of thinking.
And okay. To what end?
In a way that let's see, and I'm trying to trying to remember the name of I don't know if it's Dan Crevel who said that, or maybe Clausewitz. I don't remember now, and I'm sorry for that. Who said that we need to learn to understand peace in order to do war? Okay, and I think, you know, we have to understand what is their how did you understand their peace? Okay, how did you understand how it's going to end?
How the other side understands,
yes,
how it's going to,
yes,
end.
Yes, because, you know, in our side, and I argue with the fact that for our side, we apply rule, international rule, but we do fight with someone who doesn't apply international rule, okay? And we have to know that, even though we kind of guess, and we kind of we have a certain, let's say that, a certain knowledge of it, I think, you know. But we have to enter almost into that discourse in order for us to really engage, okay? And if we want to so-called win, okay, so-called win.
Go ahead. One sec. So let's just follow that thread a little bit. In World War II, I'm always reminded of this example because people know my family. My late father was from Dresden. So the Allies bombed Dresden in one night at the end of the Second World War, and there were tens of thousands of casualties in one night. And the city was basically, in many ways, obliterated. Many of the landmarks were destroyed and so on. This was not considered... I don't think the English had a great sort of grip of guilt about doing this. So I'm wondering, like, how do we think about this now?
Can I give a sort of brief methodological introduction?
Sure.
Because I want to sort of justify my presence up here in a certain sense. So I think that, as Dr. Kashmir mentioned, there is a tradition, right, there's a tradition of just war theory, both in terms of justifications for war and means of fighting wars. And that has a long history, which we could debate how well it's worked. Mm-hmm. But it has a long history. Jewish tradition has a very long history also for, you know, between the, you know, for about 1,500 more than that years, there was no capacity for Jews to fight a war in that regard. And so it's not a live, practical tradition in that way. So the interesting opportunity is, what we have here is the intersection of a period where it's not clear that just war theory is working well, so there's a tradition that has a long history of practice behind it, which is hitting new circumstances, which is not particularly necessarily dealing with well. And intellectual tradition, which has vast resources, but has really no experience of knowing how its ideas work. And the challenge is to try and put those two together in some useful ways.
So you're saying actually that it was sort of a moot point, Jewishly. It was theoretical.
Yeah.
Jews weren't going to war. They were powerless. And oddly enough, when Jews now have the capacity to go to war, the rules are changing as we speak.
So I think that there's a real chance to think, right, but I think we have to acknowledge that we're constructing any notion of a Jewish just war theory, and you can't say anything authoritative about that. But on the other hand, if you start from the standpoint that you don't necessarily assume the truth of the just war tradition, so then you can ask certain questions that may not be legitimate in the other sense. So I think there are a couple of questions that are worth asking in that framework. So one is the nature of the combatant non-combatant distinction. So I guess I like to approach it from an exactly opposite perspective, which is that if you take as a fundamental ethical principle that you're not allowed to, that you can't distinguish among human beings, and all human lives are worth the same, then you have to ask the question, what justifies the combatant-noncombatant distinction? Now, I think that there is a good ground for doing that, which is along the lines of what Professor Kasher said, which is some notion of believing that there's value in allowing people to live a normal life. But I don't think it's an obvious thing that combatants are people holding weapons and non-combatants are people not holding weapons. I think that becomes much more involved in issues of reciprocity. So, for example, the notion that people working in arms factories mm-hmm. are non-combatants, whereas people working at desk jobs in the military are combatants, is not an obvious thing to me, and it's not clear that that is necessarily a function of something other than convention. So that, I think, is one issue that needs to be framed in this regard. The second issue, I think, is... So I dislike the term innocent civilian, because the contrast is guilty soldier. And I don't think that soldiers are necessarily guilty. I don't think that civilians are necessarily innocent. And so I don't think the combatant-civilian distinction should be grounded on moral categories of innocence and guilt. So I think that also needs to be examined. So certainly, in terms of the way you framed the original question, I think that there is a difference between a war that is constructed as a political battle between two groups, all of whom in some sense have to bear political responsibility for the actions of the combatants. That's the United States, right? If we vote for war, or we as a democracy, we allow people to go to war, so I don't see myself as quite as innocent as somebody whom, right, as somebody whom a terrorist group comes in and hijacks, right, and hijacks my territory against my will, and I have no real control or political responsibility for the existence of that terrorist group in that location. I think that a lot of the complexity of the issues in Gaza, et cetera, is the ambiguity of the relationship of the civilians to the fighting force. I think we can all agree that if a group of unarmed people stands, right, creates a wedge in front of a group of armed people, right, or holds hands around them and says, you can't shoot them without shooting me, that they have ceased to be non-combatants. What they are unarmed combatants. Right, I think that there's, on the other hand, if somebody puts a gun at somebody and says, walk in front of me, then what you are is a non-combatant who has been dragooned. And so I think a lot of the issues that come up here relate to the question that we're not really sure. And then it's one more issue, and then I think I'm happy to go on, which is, I'm not convinced in the way Professor Kasher says that it's quite as easy to apply proportionality in terms of military advantage. And this relates to your second question, because what constitutes a military advantage is politically defined.
No.
That's where I'm really right. That's where I think we're going to disagree fundamentally. That I'm not convinced that it's as obvious that you can say what constitutes a military advantage on the basis of purely local tactical considerations. But that's where I have difficulty with the easy application of the category of proportionality and the professionalization. I know we had this conversation Friday night. I'm not so convinced about that.
Reply.
Yeah, I want to, before you reply to that, though, I want to go back to the original example. You know, it seemed that in previous conflicts, states were willing to do an enormous amount of damage, not just to combatants, but to civilians to achieve their goals. Would you say that this is, in other words, and the way you spoke about the IDF, that does not seem to be the reigning ideology there, which is to win at all costs. Has something changed?
First of all, one should get rid of the whole notion of victory, of winning. I mean, okay, Winston Churchill spoke about victory by all means, okay? But that's obsolete. I mean, yeah. When you fight an organization, a terrorist organization, then you reach the end state that you want to reach is completely different from the end state you were interested in reaching when you fought a state. When the Allies gained the huge victory over Nazi Germany, then Germany as a war machine ended to exist, could not attack the UK anymore, or the US, or Canada, or any other of the Allies. I mean, it was the end of that organized violence. However, when we fight, we wage an operation against the Hezbollah or the Hamas. At the end of it, they are able to go on shooting at us. They have still thousands of rockets, the Hamas, and the Hezbollah tens of thousands of rockets. So we do not destruct it once and for
right. But let me rehearse the view from the right here.
Okay.
The view from the right obviously would be you didn't destroy them. Destroying them would mean you obliterate them. In other words, you carpet bomb them into extinction, right? That I'm not saying I agree with this position, but in other words, when this comes up and you say you fight them but they still remain with weapons, so you make sure that they don't remain with anything. So what would be the situation at that point?
We are interested in accomplishing our missions. Okay, you should know how it works. I mean, a government doesn't send the military to fight telling them, gain victory. I mean, this is not the way it works. The American government in Iraq, the Israeli government in Gaza, and the Canadians, wherever they fight, I mean, it works differently. They're given missions. They're given certain missions. So the end of the military force is to accomplish those missions, period. Now, accomplishing those missions doesn't mean that the Hezbollah ceases to exist. I mean, but the Hamas finished attacking Israel, okay? So the situation within the southern part or central part of Israel became better, okay? The safety and security of people has improved. That was the mission. And you mentioned that Prime Minister Netanyahu was not trying to discard Hamas from the books of existence. Now, it's impossible. I mean, it's something impossible, but to do by a military operation. Now, carpet bombing is out of the question. I mean, you are a democracy. The fact that democracies did it in World War II doesn't mean anything. It means that they were wrong. I mean, they were morally wrong. And we shouldn't do it. I mean, we should not just attack civilians in order to what? To demoralize them, in order to push them to surrender. They are not going to be pushed to surrender anyway. And even if this is a way of pushing them to surrender, I don't want to be that kind of a person who just destroys numerous civilians because that's the way that people destructed Dresden or London or Nagasaki. So I don't want to be that kind of a person.
But even if the price is, I understand you perfectly, but in other words, what that engenders is the following scenario. You do not destroy them, which automatically guarantees in a way that they will come back at you every 2 to 3 years for an infinite amount of time. So are you saying that that is the preferable scenario for Israeli governments?
No, I'm not saying the preferable scenario is peace.
No, but realistically speaking, that does not seem to be on the table right now.
Okay.
So in terms of the two options that seem to be on the table, it's preferable to have these sort of recurrent engagements than to do what you consider morally reprehensible.
Okay, first of all, peace is on the table. Negotiations are on the table. We can try to pursue peace. We are never allowed to stop pursuing peace in a democracy. Peace is the ultimate iron dome of both of the civilians and the combatants, right? If there is peace, we have peace with Egypt. No Israeli soldier got killed in a battle with the Egyptians since we signed the accord with Egypt, right? That's the ultimate iron dome. So peace is something that we ought to pursue. Now, assume that we are unable now to strike a peace with the Hamas. Okay, so the idea is to deter them from attacking us. Look at the second Lebanon war. It was 2006, right? So it's quite a while since they attacked us. And the secretary of Hezbollah, Nasrallah, said it openly. Had he known in advance that this would be the Israeli reaction to the abduction and killing of soldiers at the border with Lebanon, then he wouldn't have done it. which means he admitted that we deterred him from attacking us again. Now, if he does attack us again, then it is a possibility. And it is a possibility, one has to take it into account, although the newspapers don't write about it too much. I mean, when Hamas fights with us, or the Hezbollah fights with us, it's Iran that fights with us, because they are both proxy organizations of Iran. So it's much more complicated than it seems. But if Iran will take us through the Hezbollah or through the Hamas, then we'll defend ourselves in an attempt, first of all, to gain the defense and, as a byproduct, to create deterrence. Now, I'd like to have one sentence in clarification of one point. Perhaps two sentences. Two brief sentences. First of all, innocence, the notion of innocence is just a mistranslation of a traditional term. I mean, there is nothing to do with innocence and guilt. It's being dangerous or not. The distinction between two different types of persons on the other side of the battlefield is the distinction between those who endanger us and those who don't. The terrorist does jeopardize our life. The neighbor of the terrorist, who has nothing to do with the activities of the terrorist, does not. So that's the distinction. Now, the intelligence officer who sits in some office in Beirut or Tehran or wherever does contribute to jeopardizing us during war, during an operation. So therefore, he's dangerous and he's a combatant. Not because he's wearing military uniform, because he's involved in those in those activities. Now, the person who works in an ammunition factory, during his work in the factory, that's standard international law. It's not an invention or a novelty. During his work in the ammunition factory, he is a legitimate target. They endanger us because he supplies the enemy with ammunition, and we are allowed to kill those seemingly civilians who work in an ammunition factory. Now, when he's in his residential area entertaining his children with his wife, I mean, then he's not a legitimate target. There he is a civilian. Now, finally, the proportionality considerations. I've never said, I mean, if that is the impression, I apologize, that it's easy to make it. It's a very complicated professional decision. It's a military professional decision, the consideration of proportionality. Now, what you militarily gain for a battalion commander or brigade commander is derived from the missions that commander has been assigned during the briefing before going to the operation or the war. So there is a set of missions, and he knows, and this is his activity, those missions, to accomplish those missions. Now, he knows exactly well what he's going to gain militarily from his activity, because his activities are all meant for accomplishment of his missions. So he knows how this kind of shelling or raiding or assaulting or whatever is going to contribute to the mission that he has to accomplish, because this is the mission he has assigned. So this is military professional decision. And making an evaluation of the expected collateral damage is also a military professional decision. You need intelligence. You need knowledge. You need to know the whereabouts. Have they evacuated the places or not? Do they stay there or not? You have to use the intelligence you get from all the resources at your disposal, from Vizint and Humint and SIGINT and whatever. So it's a professional, it's a complicated professional decision. But since they are professionals, they're career officers, they learn how to make those decisions.
Maybe we'll come back. If you don't, I'll ask a question, but if you do, go ahead.
I guess there's still two things that I don't really I think one point I think really needs to be made, and I think this is the distinction between ethics and law. And law is often arbitrary, and you have to think about whether the arbitrary distinctions that necessarily need to be made for the sake of law hold up. And they're, you know, let's say, for example, you can imagine a ridiculous scenario in which the ammunition factory has a radar, and as soon as the planes are overhead, everybody stops working and says, "Ha! Look, now we're civilians. We're not actively endangering you right now." That doesn't make any sense. The notion that you treat people as civilians while they're in the factory, but on their way home, even though they're going to be back in the factory 8 hours later, right? I think those are arbitrary distinctions that we make because it has become conventionally useful to allow them to define them as core ethical distinctions is a problematic notion for me. I also just, I guess, want to make the point that I think non-democracies also have ethical obligations. And I don't think that the nature of obligations are intrinsic on the being a democracy. And the third thing is, I think this is really a fundamental issue. The nature of the missions one is given are defined, right, is not, I don't think that we are living in a world in which the military is given a very clear mission and the military just goes on and carries out that mission professionally, and there isn't the constant intersection, particularly in these kinds of wars where we're not fighting country against country, but we're a core part of the issue. In Israel, certainly, I hope everyone's considering the impact of a particular military mission on the Arab population of the state of Israel, right? Because part of the end game is trying to figure out what the internal condition of the state of Israel will be, if there's a group of undecided people politically, and the U.S. is thinking about this in Afghanistan all the time. And in Iraq, you talk to military officers in both Afghanistan and Iraq, and what constitutes a military advantage is not a tactical thing. It's, right, if I do this and I walk back into that same village in a week, will anybody say hello to me? Will anybody be willing to give me information? All those sorts of things. So I don't buy that some of these distinctions are core ethical distinctions as opposed to conventions that are fundamentally dependent on reciprocity. And that's why I also think that we are having the entire conversation as if you can completely distinguish the grounds for war from the legitimate means of carrying out the war. And I don't think that's necessarily true either. I think that if you take the premise, which I share fully with Professor Kasher, that all other things being equal, peace is preferable to war, and even many things being unequal, peace is still preferable to war. But I think it matters a great deal by how much you will lose if you have peace as opposed to war. World War II is a particular phenomenon because World War II can be understood. Whether or not the British and Americans understood it this way is an interesting question, but it can be understood as a war to prevent the enemy from committing genocide against its own population. Now, that is also a unique phenomenon. Right? When you are fighting the enemy, in a sense, because you're attempting to intervene in its own moral decisions regarding its own population. Now, I think that the calculation that takes place often is, and I think this is the challenge that that Dr. Walzer raises, Dr. Kasher, is the relative evaluation of military and civilian lives, which I've talked about earlier. But there's another question, which is what happens if a particular military action against civilians will save other civilian lives? And I think that part of the moral challenge in fighting organizations such as Hamas is that its military goal may not be the destruction of your soldiers, but the death of your civilians. And the question about when what you're attempting to gain is the protection of your civilians as opposed to the triumph of your soldiers, it seems to me that that is also a different moral calculus that requires a different kind of conversation.
Let me just pick up on that point, which is really a very interesting point. I want to ask you, like from a Canadian point of view, let's take an example of what I think you're alluding to, Rabbi Clapper. So let's take Rwanda in 1994. There were 800,000 people killed in 90 days, which is actually a faster rate of killing than the Holocaust. And there you have, right, the Hutus and the Tutsis. And so what would be the policy of the West if one civilian side is massacring another civilian side, or one faction of the country is? So would it be moral to go in as an outside agent and go in and not just sort of dither around, but actually forcibly contain one of those factions. In other words, go in and kill the aggressor. Would that be something that the West could, would do, should do?
Well,
and how did we think about that?
There was General Dallaire's dilemma.
Right. Yes,
there was General Dallaire's dilemma because he tried to stop it. He tried to everything he could to stop that. Okay.
Oh. And what did he do?
One example, if you read his book, for example, maybe we have to put everything in a context here. General Dallaire and maybe other officers in the Canadian forces, Israeli forces, they are professional military members, okay, and they wait for orders, okay. The thing that we believe that what we see in television, that military commanders and all that stuff, they are glorious and all that stuff. I think, you know, it's not as glorious as we think. General Dallaire at one point wanted to have the permission to uncover a cache of arms, okay, and that he knew.
That he knew were being used against innocents, right?
And he was declined. He said no.
The government said you're not allowed to do that.
Not do that, okay? And the question when we can look back and judge General Dallaire and say what we want and say, well, he should have done it. He should have just do. He should have. Not following orders, okay. Knowing personally General Dallaire and his right arm, or not Ed Decomb, but Major Bilsley, who suffered a lot of PTSD after he came back, he says General Dallaire was a very professional soldier who couldn't say no to an order. He said, "No, I have to follow orders," okay. And he wanted to prevent that. By preventing that, that was a mechanism to prevent it. And for him, it was not saying, okay, I will go and get it and I will get permission after. No, I will get permission first and I will get it. Was it a mistake? Well, the world will judge that.
You know. So you're saying he was stuck in a way between the politician's directive to him, which was saying no, and what his eyes were viewing, which was sort of saying, yes, I need to intervene, I need to stop genocide. And the soldier at that point, you're saying, is completely, he's constricted, in other words, because he doesn't know what to do.
Yeah.
Anyways, but this gets to your point from before, and I also was curious, when you were talking about the soldier sees missions, but it's not just about the soldier's missions, it's about the government's policy. When I was asking the question about whether we want to win the war, I wasn't asking about whether the soldier wants to win the war. I was asking about whether it's the policy of Western governments now to win at all costs, regardless of casualties, to achieve their goals, which you seem to be suggesting is no. And you're also suggesting that that decision, which was made in World War II, was probably an immoral decision to sort of, create that kind of damage.
No, I'm saying that the interest that Churchill showed in gaining victory was absolutely justified. And gaining victory in a war of the kind of not necessarily World War II, could be Six-Day War in Israel, okay, when Israel fought the Egyptian and the Jordanian and the Syrian military forces. They're gaining victory, which means destructing their military ability for a certain period, that is justified. What I'm saying now, that destruction of that kind is nowadays impossible. So gaining a victory is dead. It's obsolete. It's an obsolete notion. What we have is accomplishing missions. And governments give their military forces missions. And those missions ought to be accomplished. Now, those governments are political entities. So they, on the governmental disk, the operation is related to some policies. That is correct. But when it comes to proportionality considerations and the distinction that should be kept, I mean, this is not political. This is professional. But let me say something about...
But the argument seems circular to me. In other words, you're saying it's to achieve missions, but obviously the achievement of the missions is to some larger goal, no?
The missions are part of an operation. The operation is given to the army, and the operation is intended to accomplish certain missions, larger missions. Okay, the larger mission is to stop the attacks of Hamas over Israel. Okay, for as much as possible, which means that do it in an effective way and try to have as a byproduct deterrence, effective deterrence.
And you're saying that's the limit of what government policy will allow or command.
That's the limits of of what is possible.
So it's not possible to defeat these enemies.
It's not a moral question. It's a feasibility question. I mean, it's impossible. Think about the Second Lebanon War. Okay, I mean, after ceasefire was achieved. Okay. During the last day of hostilities, the Hezbollah shot at Israel hundreds of rockets. And a day later, they could have launched the same number of rockets over Israel. So we did not destruct their military ability, because their military ability is the ability of a person to have in his cellar those magazine full of rockets, and then have a donkey that will carry the launcher from one place to another and launch it over Israel. I mean, it's a primitive. It's not a war of, you know, cyber war with airplanes and submarines. It's a war with donkeys and launchers and launching devices.
Let me see if I understand you correctly. You're saying that the difference between the Nazis and Hamas/ISIS/Hezbollah is that the latter are ideologically committed to never stopping. In other words, because it seems asymmetrical to say that we could defeat the Nazis, but that Hamas is undefeatable for all time. And the only conclusion I can draw for that is because Hamas simply will not accept any sort of state in which they would stop fighting.
What I'm saying is, independent of the question whether they are willing to fight endlessly or not, assume they are, I mean, the Hamas are willing to fight endlessly, so it seems. But assume the Hamas is not interested in fighting endlessly, but is interested in fighting for a certain period in order to achieve something. It doesn't change the situation where you cannot destruct them. You can just accomplish your missions, which are defending your citizens and yourself in a certain way for a certain period. So I must say something about the Hutu with it, Tutsi. I mean, it's so odd that this question is, that the question about whether the world should intervene or not is still being raised by Jews. It is absolutely odd in my books. I mean, think about what the world did during the Holocaust, during World War II. Okay? There is a famous picture of a bomb above Auschwitz. But if you know anything about pictures of bombs above sites, then you understand that this bomb was not meant for Auschwitz. It was meant for an adjacent site, because the bomb flies like that from the airplane. Okay, so what did the world do when the world faced, even our friends, right, the allies, what did they do when we were victims of a genocide, of an industrial genocide? I mean, what did they do? Nothing, right? I mean, nothing. Here and there, there is a story about some commander or another. But as governments, they did nothing. And it's unforgivable. It's unforgivable. I mean, telling us that it would obstruct the ways of gaining some local victories concerning in certain battles is unacceptable. So, indeed, there must be a way to intervene. It doesn't mean that everyone should intervene. I don't think that Israel should intervene in Syria nowadays, right? But the world should intervene. I mean, it's impossible to keep silent when tens of thousands of Syrians get killed by their government or by the enemies of that government. I mean, Israel should have voiced its abhorrence given that situation. Israel should not intervene, I repeat, should not intervene, should not send troops or planes or tanks or whatever. But Israel should have told the world, look at our neighbor, it's Syria. I mean, it's intolerable to just, you know, turn a blind eye. And the world, unless it came to the chemical weaponry, the world did not care at all. Which is something Israel should... I mean, Ben Gurion, the first prime minister of Israel, talked in terms of an exemplary society. Okay? Exemplary society. Israel should be exemplary society. Okay, now when you talk to the youth, they're so cynical about being an exemplary society, given a state where a former president, former prime minister, former chief rabbi, former minister of finance, former minister of whatever, are in jail. Okay, so what kind of an exemplary society is it? But it could be an exemplary society. It could be. I mean, okay, there are all kinds of problems that ought to be solved, and part of the solution is that those people serve time in jail. But Israel should voice its view, its moral view, whenever an atrocity of the size of a genocide or a size of tens of thousands of people getting killed by the government or its enemy. We should be there on the arena where people speak against it.
Well, let's just take that point and expand it a little bit. I want to get back to something you said before because he's really touching on this. The real question is, like, Ad Kan, right? If you think about the amount of civilian atrocity that goes on around the world in the last 20 years, so if there's a principle of intervention, and by this I assume you don't just mean screaming at the UN, but boots on the ground, so we could be going into East Timor, we could be going into Rwanda, we could be going into, in the 70s, we could be going into Cambodia. It'd be endless where we could go. So what sort of principle do we actually have for saving people from themselves?
So I think there are really three ways you have to answer that question. One is the difference between World War II, where you were not going in exclusively to save people from themselves, but it is true that the enemy you were fighting was committing genocide against his population. Then you have the question of what sorts of price you have to pay overall, right? If you have to intervene everywhere, and I think that's the problem Israel would have. And then there's the question of under what circumstances intervention in general, right, is you're justified in risking your own troops for any purpose at all for other people's populations. So that one actually I have written about and sort of committed to, based on the Holocaust experience. So I tried to argue, but again, I want to be clear that I'm setting up a model within Jewish tradition, which may or may not, it's not an authoritative model, it's an attempt to begin. What I tried to argue was that there is, in fact, that in private Jewish law, there is a category called rodef, and the category called rodef sets up an obligation on third parties to intervene when person A is trying to kill person B, person C has an obligation to intervene. So what I tried to argue is that that may exist on a national or political group level as well, and that when political group A is attempting to exterminate political group B, there's an obligation on political group C to intervene. Now that sets up a sharp distinction, which is a challenging one, between a circumstance such as Syria, where many, many thousands of people are dying, but they don't constitute any kind of identifiable group, and situations like Rwanda, right, which is actually genocide, where you're trying to kill a kind, as opposed to, right, that I think is a humanitarian obligation, but probably doesn't justify endangering other people, right, ordering some people to risk their lives for others. That probably legitimates calling for volunteers, I think, but doesn't legitimate politically committing some people's lives for the sake of others, whereas I think that genocide, again, put in the calculation, you have to figure out, Israel can't put its troops in Rwanda if the result is that its own population is going to be massacred by an invading Syrian army the next day. But in principle, I think that there is an obligation of military intervention to prevent genocide, framed that way, which does not apply to all circumstances where one government is being oppressive to its others.
So now I'm actually confused, because on the one hand you're saying that it's not justified in all cases. In the Rwanda case, I think you said it should be volunteers.
No. The Rwanda case was genocide.
Because so the outside world should come in and forcibly stop one side from killing the other, even if that country is not endangering anybody else.
I think that is the moral lesson as Jews we derive from the Holocaust. I think it's one of the amazing things about the experience of Jews having been in the United States. Like one of the, I think, unprecedented history. Maybe it's true in Canada also. I apologize if not. But the notion that Jews feel that the United States did something wrong by not bombing Auschwitz, right? That we feel that the United States had an obligation to intervene on our behalf generates an obligation of reciprocity. Therefore, we must feel, right? We can't think they have an obligation to intervene on our behalf because we're the Jews. Right, we have to think that there's something about the Holocaust that generated such an obligation. I'm suggesting that what generated it was the category of genocide.
So you're arguing that even if Nazi Germany had endangered nobody else
but the Jews
and was simply killing the Jews
yes.
in their own domain, that the world should come in and intervene.
Yes.
And that is a distinction that you would draw in other
yes.
domains, areas of conflict. So if countries are actually persecuting and destroying their own people in the tens of thousands, then other countries should come in morally.
No. I'm making a very sharp distinction between a country that is cruel to its citizens, but not in a way which is genocide, meaning the destruction of a defined group. Right? As I don't think there's an obligation to intervene in North Korea. Right? North Korea is doing horrible things to its population. I don't think there's an obligation to intervene there. I think that Rwanda was different because it was the attempted annihilation of a particular group, and that's what I think genocide.
That's a moral distinction that utterly escapes me.
Okay.
If you forcibly starve 5 million people, whether they're a defined group or a non-defined group, you're obviously committing a process of slow or quick genocide. When 5 million people died in the Congo because of fighting, so if you can, the question then becomes: can you locate the aggressor? But if you can locate the aggressor, which North Korea seems to be locatable, I'm not sure I follow.
It's a chiddush, right? It's a creative. It's an attempt. I don't believe that there can realistically be an obligation to intervene in the immoral internal affairs of every other political community. And I think that there. On the same time, I think that that there is a reasonable Jewish moral consensus, as Dr. Kasher articulated, that was the case with regard to the Holocaust. Okay. I don't think it can be numbers that makes the distinction. So I'm trying to generate a different.
A few sentences on it. I mean, the world has tried to develop a doctrine called R2P, which is responsibility to protect. Protect. Responsibility to protect means that if people are under attack, who cares for what reason? Right, whether they form a certain ethnical group or religious group or color group or race group or political group within the state that is in the opposition, then if a sizable group is under attack, then the world should be organized in a way, in particular through the Security Council, if possible, to intervene, to send military forces to intervene. Now it's impractical for the world, and even immoral perhaps, for the world to be involved in every infringement of human rights in every state, right? If you think there's something wrong concerning human rights in terms of the discrimination against women in synagogues, okay, does that give you a reason for interfering? Or, I mean, for another state to interfere in the business, in the situation.
No, but you know that we're not talking about
okay.
that. And you know that that is a false example.
No,
and you know that we are talking about mass killing
of
civilians
okay.
in different countries.
So what I'm saying
so there's a difference between impractical and immoral. And this is the distinction you drew with Hamas also. So I want to ask you, when you say we can't destroy Hamas, are you saying it's because it's not practical or because it's not moral? Because it's actually the same question that you're dealing with here, which is when you say it's impractical to go into places, I can understand that. If you say it's immoral to intervene, I want to understand that argument.
It's impractical. It's first of all, it's impractical in the sense that it destroys the whole idea of sovereignty. Okay? And we don't want to get rid of the idea of sovereignty. We are not interested in a world government. Okay, so some people are, but most of the world, almost the whole world, is not interested in the notion of world government. So sovereignty plays a role. And sovereignty means that there is, if there is something wrong concerning human rights in a certain state, indeed everyone can speak about it, but it's the business of that state to improve the situation of those who are discriminated against. In this sense, it's impractical. Now, concerning the Hamas, if you think about the Hamas as a military force, as a military force, you can distract them more. You can hit them more than you did, but you cannot distract once and forever and for all their ability to attack you. Because, as I said earlier, it takes just, you know, a seller and a donkey and a launcher to go on attacking you. So there is, it's impractical in the sense that whatever you do,
so they won't give up, is what they, you're saying.
Not whether they are willing to give up or not is another issue. They have the ability. I'm not, okay, sometimes you think about victory as distracting their will to fight, which is an is important insight. But I'm not interested in their will. I'm interested in their ability. Okay, so I cannot destruct their ability.
Okay.
And by deterrence, you try to destruct their willingness, but it's very temporary.
After the war, after the Second War, we said nothing. We said that we hope that something like that will never happen again. It's true, and we said that. After Rwanda, Major Beardsley, who is suffer a lot of PTSD and he has to be retired from the military, wrote a very good article saying that we said after Rwanda, never happen again. And we let it happen somewhere else in the world, okay? We did it. The R are... It's the international community who has to stand up. It's not only us, you, me. It's if we say that we hold higher ground, moral higher ground, if I say that, I have to prove it that I have higher moral ground.
Which would mean that we'd have to go in and intervene, yes. You're saying.
Yeah. If we say that, you know, people have been killed, people have been destroyed, people have been, they try to eliminate people in masses. I think, you know, we have, ethically, we are bound as an international community. We are bound to go and help, whatever we do. And I think, you know, this, we cannot just stand and say and enjoy our freedom, enjoy our supper and dinner and everything we enjoyed in life, we're pretending that doesn't exist. I think we should learn from our mistakes, and sometimes people don't learn from their mistakes. And of course, I'm not naive to know that governments have also the interest in going in some places.
Yeah,
and some people say, well, what are we going to do in which country? What are they going to provide us if we go there in return, for example? And we all know that. I'm sorry, I'm getting a bit excited here. But it's just that we are all responsible. I think we're all responsible for providing that. We cannot allow that to happen again.
So let's talk about the end game then, all right? Because I think that's really where you're taking us. Let's assume then that the enemy, either on ideological grounds or practical grounds, doesn't really ever give up because there's still somebody in a basement with a donkey and a launcher. Okay, I like that image. So what we're suggesting here is almost a kind of, I wouldn't say a stalemate, but there's a sense that you're living inside of this paradox, which is that you are hitting them, but you're not destroying them, and they're going to come after you. Are we saying here that this is the best we're going to get in the West? And is it the moral best that we should get in the West?
Who should answer?
In other words, let me make it plainer. The alternative is total annihilation of your enemy, right? You go in and you use any means possible. Let me make it even plainer. You'd kill every single human being in Gaza, all of them. Okay? So, and the reason I'm giving you this extreme is that not anybody, you know, there may be somebody who advocates for that, but it's not me. But it makes, it puts it in sharp relief, right? We'd win. So you're arguing, I'm sure, that the moral cost of that is too much, and you're also arguing that you wouldn't win, really, because as soon as you kill them all, somebody would pop up and start the cycle again.
It wouldn't be we.
Right.
It would be some monster.
Right, I understand. Okay, so now I think so in other words, it really doesn't come down to a 0-100 calculation. It's always something that's going to happen.
And there is an additional dimension that you must mention. I mean, okay, the Hamas are not going to change their covenant, okay, within the foreseeable future.
Right.
Assume that. However, we should pursue peace because there are other Palestinians as well. Mm-hmm. And pursue peace doesn't mean that tomorrow we'll strike an agreement with the Palestinians, with the president of the Palestinian Authority. But we must pursue it. We must pursue it in order to try to gain some defense of our citizens and combatants from becoming casualties in the military.
But that's not going to stop the guy with the donkey and the launchers.
That might help in the longer range stop the guy with the donkey and the
okay.
launcher.
All right.
I'm nervous about the use of certain kinds of fantasies to, the fantasy that you can actually exterminate everyone in Gaza and that doing that will eliminate all your enemies and not create new enemies.
I want you to know I have fantasies, but that's not one of them.
Okay. Yeah, so I'm very nervous about the.
I'm getting nervous too.
I'm very nervous about. All right, because I know that there are people who explicitly, carpet bomb, and you think that you win.
Right.
I think there are two points that I would make Jewishly in this regard.
Yeah.
One is that Rabbi Moshe David Tendler, in an interesting article which regrettably lacks all evidence but nonetheless is true, makes I think the very powerful claim that when you're dealing with political communities, you have to think about long-term goals in a way which individuals don't have to. And so there are always long-term costs to fighting wars of extermination, especially when you're not popular to begin with. And so I think it's the notion that that total war in that context is a long-term good political achievement, a good political result, that's a fantasy, and I think we should take it off the table. The second question, which I think Professor Kasher was talking about, which is really powerful as well, is there's a basic challenge in trying to allow numbers to be relevant to ethics. Right? This is part of the challenge of proportionality. Right? Say, what is the thing that lets you kill 15 civilians but not 16? What's your boundary? 17, 18, 19, 20? Right? So there's a fundamental notion of challenge in allowing quantity to affect quality. And yet, at some point, there is, I think, the halacha, and when you apply halacha, so people sometimes, I think, make mistaken equations. Well, if it's okay to kill one person, it must be okay to kill a million, because what's the difference? Halakhically, one in a million are the same. I don't think that's true. I think that there's work needed in halakha to try and figure out these boundaries. But I'll give you a useful halakhic illustration. Probably all of you who are educated halakhically know that there are three mitzvot that you have to die before committing, and those are idolatry, shorthand idolatry, adultery, and murder. And those are absolutes. We teach you that in elementary school. Those are absolutes. And then a really interesting question comes up, which is what happens if somebody, if you have a whole busload of people, this is a real case, right? You have a whole busload of people, and they're being threatened by a terrorist group, and they're going to kill everybody, and there's a married woman on the bus, and she has the opportunity to seduce one of the terrorists and thereby save the entire, right, and thereby save the entire caravan. Now, this is, I'm not actually making this case up. This is actually a real case in the responsible literature, not just as a hypothetical, but as an actual. It's in the Maharik. And the Maharik decides that it is the right thing to do. Now, why is it the right thing to do? There's no, Right. So you have, on the one hand, you have an inclination in the Gemara. The Gemara seems to understand the case.
The right thing for whom? For the woman.
For the woman.
For the woman, not for the other guy on the bus.
No, no. The right thing for the woman. And but you have two parameters. On the one hand, you have this halachic rule that says you can never commit adultery. You have to give up your life. And on the other hand, you have this case in the Gemara where the Gemara says that the Gemara understands the biblical narrative of Yael as Yael committing adultery to save the entire Jewish people. And now you have the case, what happens if you're not saving the entire Jewish people, you're just saving a bunch of people. And so that creates a whole halachic literature, and what generates the moral pressure is just numbers. Just the shift from one life to others. I think that there is a point at which you say, you know what, that's a whole lot of people, and we'd be different people, exactly as Dr. Kasher says, we'd be, right, that just can't be, even if in a formal argument it's very hard to say, why is it okay to kill 2,000 people, but not okay to kill 500,000? I don't think that is likely to be abstractly, right, formulatable in terms of rules, although, as in many other cases, it's useful to construct arbitrary rules, because otherwise people have no basis for their behavior.
Right here. Last thoughts?
Just one word that I'd like to cross out of the discussion, namely arbitrary. I mean, nothing is arbitrary. I mean, there are reasons behind anything, behind everything. It's not arbitrarily formulated as such. I mean, sometimes you can say that it's fuzzy. I mean, the borders could be blurred, but it's not arbitrary. I mean, and when you do the proportionality considerations, what you gain is sometimes justifies 20,000 casualties, but not a million casualties. It could be the case. It could be sometimes it could be the case that it is justified to cause much more collateral damage if what is at stake is the life of the whole population, annihilation, and things like this. But I think we should just not indulge in extreme hypothetical examples. Well, I mean, which are not what we have to think about, and the decisions we make are not related to them, to those extreme hypothetical cases. We should think about the ordinary cases, okay? I'll give you one example briefly. Think about collateral damage in Operation Protective Edge. At one point, a certain officer was abducted. Okay, towards the end of the operation. One was abducted. And then they used a procedure called Hannibal, and they used a lot of fire to stop the abductors from running away with the abducted soldier. He was killed. I mean, eventually it was clear that he was killed in a minute. But they thought that perhaps he's alive, and that should be stopped. Now, what was the proportionality consideration? Why did they use so much fire? I mean, the Palestinians immediately said that there were 200 casualties. I mean, in the debriefing of the Israelis in the IDF, it was found that there were 40. But 40 is also 40 tragedies. They are non-dangerous people. I don't like to think about them as insignificant. I mean, there are 40 tragedies. But not 200, because figures coming from Gaza Strip and Palestinian sources are always unreliable, whatever they are. So the commander, the brigade commander that used so much fire, had the following consideration. On the one hand, it's causing a certain number of casualties, okay? 100 plus minus. On the other hand, in Israel, at the time, the idea of an abducted soldier is of strategic importance. So what that brigade commander, that colonel, had in mind was the following idea. Okay, I'm going to foil a strategic collapse. And in order to foil a strategic collapse, you may cause a lot of collateral damage. That was his type of consideration. So he was right in terms of, okay, if it's falling a strategic collapse, then you may cause a lot of collateral damage. However, it is a mistake to think that an abduction of one soldier is of strategic importance. I mean, it was just the public mood It's not something that has to do with real strategies and real effects over strategies. The Gilad Shalit campaign, if you know the story, the Gilad Shalit campaign created this kind of irresponsible atmosphere according to which the abduction of one single soldier is of strategic importance. It's not. So you see that there are different considerations that go into the calculation. For example, whether it's strategic or not has to do with the number of people who are going to die as collateral damage.
Last thoughts?
You want to
yes,
talk
no?
About? I think you're talking about.
Okay. So the issues remain challenging, as you can see, and without easy solution, but we want to thank our speakers for engaging them with this evening. Thank you very much.
They can ask questions. They can ask questions.
Okay, so we'll do a few minutes of questions, but I want to make it, we're going to do it very quickly, one round. If people can line up, you have less than 30 seconds to ask your question. We're going to take 5-6 questions at once. They're going to answer them, and then we'll do the questions privately. So we'll spend approximately 10 minutes or so on the questions, 10 minutes privately.
Thank you.
Because we have to be back here at 9:30 in the morning. I know the night is still relatively young, but okay, so please ask your question.
I just wanted to make one point. Professor Kosher and I are going to go back at it tomorrow on religious warfare, as we're going to talk about Yeshaya Leibowitz at 10:30, so you're all invited to see that.
Yes. That's a one-on-one. Okay. Bakasha.
Okay, I have a question. Professor Kosher said that we don't want to deal with extreme situation, but I still want to raise an extreme situation, but it's a plausible situation. Let's say Iran acquires the atomic bomb. The Prime Minister of Israel gets intelligence information that there is a reasonable probability that they are going to bomb Israel with atomic bombs. Is there a moral justification for Israel based on that kind of information to use its power to strike Iran and kill probably a lot of people based on that kind of information?
Okay, next question.
I just wanted to raise this. I mean, the discussion was reasonably dispassioned, I think, compared to others, because I think nobody is really threatened. Canada is not threatened. Israel is partly threatened, but not really. So I think maybe orienting the discussion a little bit around, say, the Peshmerga fighting ISIS. So what are the ethics of war for them? I think is much more sharp discussion, because if they don't win, they're dead, sort of thing. And we've had conflicts like that, but I think it makes it much more interesting, the distinction between civilians and non-civilians and combatants and a whole bunch of other ius ad bellum, ius in bellum sort of discussions around people who are really threatened. And the second thing, just to discuss the Sri Lanka, so what Rabbi Clapper mentioned, that whether a country is a democracy or not, I think is very relevant. Israel just always, yammers on or mentions that, and I think it's irrelevant. So just maybe if they can comment on sort of what happened with the end of the war in Sri Lanka. They just basically decided we're going to end the war. They ended the war, and frankly, from a lot of NGOs that I work with in the work with the Tamils, they're even though they are politically devastated, they are actually doing a little bit better after having been beaten. So it's just sort of a couple points for discussion.
Okay, yeah, go ahead. Thank you for the presentation, Professor Kashi. I think Rabbi Clapper asked initially that you can't separate the military from the political, and you argued that you could, but your last example was exactly that the military are making decisions based on political, not on the, and not even coming from the politicians, coming from the military itself. So I'm not sure how you argued him when you brought the example exactly of what he argued against you.
Okay, so the three questions we'll begin with. If there's a potential Iran nuclear strike, is it justified to reciprocally to kill many, many Iranians in that scenario?
Well, it's a very difficult question indeed. I mean, it's better to consign it to silence. But let me say a few words about it that have been published. There was a professor of political sciences in the United States who published a paper that speculated about the results of a nuclear conflict between Israel and Iran. From somewhere he took the idea that both Iran and Israel are nuclear powers, are equipped with nuclear bombs, and from somewhere he took an evaluation of the numbers. How many bombs does Israel have? How many bombs does Iran have? And assuming that both of them are going to use whatever they have, all the arsenal of atomic weaponry on each other, then Israel is going to suffer, according to this paper, to suffer 300,000 casualties, and Iran 30 million. Which means, I don't take the Iranians to be so wicked that they are exempted from rational considerations. I don't think that they are going to destroy Israel, even if it destroys them, to an extent which that paper tries to describe. I think that for political reasons, they can stay in the present situation of being not far from being equipped with an atomic bomb, not having an atomic bomb, but 3 years from having an atomic bomb, or half a year or whatever, and that will give them all the political gains they are interested, because of which they are interested in gaining atomic weaponry. So I don't think that Israel will ever be under the real threat of being imminently attacked by missiles carrying atomic weaponry from Iran. However, for the hypothetical fantasies, if this is the situation, then you have to ask yourself whether there are some means for stopping them from doing it. Okay? Nowadays there are different means. There are diplomatic means, Security Council means, cyber warfare means, or conventional means or non-conventional means. I mean, you should ask yourself what will defend you on the one hand and what will cause minimal damage among your citizens and minimal collateral damage among Iranian people on the other hand. But I don't think that we are close to such a condition. So that's on Iran.
Right. I mean, you're assuming that the rational actor side of Iran will outweigh the sort of ideological fanaticism.
Look at the way they negotiate. Right. Look at the way they treat the Hamas and Hezbollah. Look at the way they all of a sudden, the previous president of Iran denied the Holocaust. I mean, what is he? What was he? A crazy, crazy idiot? I'm sure he had some good reasons for doing it. I mean, good, according to his interests and his values and his standards. But he knows what he's doing. I mean, the worst assumption one can make about the enemy is that the enemy is silly, stupid, idiotic, irrational. I mean, assume that your enemy is as rational as you are. They have different interests, different values. They're utterly different from you. But they're not different from you as human beings who try to pursue their ends and goals.
Okay. The second question I didn't quite catch, but certainly the last part I caught, that in Sri Lanka, was it better for the Tamils to actually be beaten to give them a chance to sort of resurrect their existence? I don't know how to answer that question, but if anyone wants it. I don't think anybody here knows.
I'd like to say a word about it. I mean, Rabbi Klepper was...
What does it justify to...
I mean, in order to give them a better future.
Not in order to give them a better future, but that's what the Sri Lankan government said, that that's what they're going to do. Would Israel be justified in doing whatever it needs to do to win whatever war, if it was winnable?
Okay.
And in so doing, perhaps even be more morally better outcome for both parties, potentially. But certainly for the one party.
Mm-hmm. The notion of democracy plays different roles here in the picture. What I spoke about was... Those are the doctrines and policies and rules and conventions used by democracies. I mean, other states are not committed to them to the same extent. The democracies are committed to them because they are democracies. It doesn't mean that they always will comply with it. But Being a democracy commits you to all kinds of restrictions, all kinds of activities that are forbidden. So there is something like democratic military ethics, democratic just war doctrine. Now, indeed, the rabbi is right in saying that a non-democratic regime also has moral obligations, right? Indeed, everyone has moral obligations. However, you cannot assume that they will endorse the doctrines and the procedures that you try to reach when you develop a democratic way of fighting terrorism. Then there is a third station of democracy, namely the end state that we try to pursue. Okay, people who are, like myself, who are for this two-state solution for the Israel-Palestinian conflict, never speak in terms of Israel as a Jewish democratic state and Palestine as a Palestinian democratic state. We are interested in the two-state solutions. We will be the Jewish state and a democratic state, and then they will be the Palestinians. Okay, whether they are going to be a democracy or not, one can guess, okay, what kind of democracy they're going to have there. So they're not going to be democratic, but this will not stop me from pursuing an agreement with them. As an intermediate stage, I think that eventually we should demand that every state be democratic, okay? The United Nations Declaration of Human Rights, Universal Declaration of Human Rights, requires that every state is a democratic, is a democracy, respects human rights in that list, requires that you are a democracy.
Let's move quickly to the third question.
Can I say something else? Because I think that the really important, we could talk about democracies and at some other point. I think the really key issue in that question is that it's very dangerous to make moral decisions, arguments based on a post facto thing. There are lots of things that if you know the outcome in advance, you can say the ends justify the means. But part of the calculation is that you can't know the outcome in advance, right? So I think that the case of the Tamils is a really good challenge to a lot of the ways in which people think about fighting terrorism right now, and it ought to be raised much more often. But the fact that it worked in one case doesn't necessarily mean that you can say, okay, so why don't we do the same thing somewhere else? Because it may not work somewhere else. The moral calculus has to include the probability of it working and not just the fact that it might work.
Well put.
Right. Which I agree with that, but in Israeli conflict, but in others.
Yes, right, I think that's right.
So the last question, which I was actually thinking about exactly that when you were answering, was that this battalion commander, you said it's like there are missions and then there are larger political things and you separated them, but he didn't seem to separate them in his own mind, because if he's making that decision based on, quote, a larger strategic consideration, then the officer in the field is actually entering into politics.
No, when the commander assumes that an abduction of a soldier is of strategic importance, then what he does is to use the input he got from his superiors. I mean, it's not his decision that this is strategic. It's given. It's a given for him. If you look at previous cases of abduction and you saw what kinds of efforts Israel made in order to get the soldiers back or even the cadavers back, then and you see the report of an inquiry commission after the second Lebanon War, what they say about abduction. I mean, so it is given as strategic. What I'm saying is that this
can you clarify that for me?
Yes.
In other words, are you saying that there's a kind of set ratio beforehand? They tell him, in this case, you would be permitted to maybe exceed the normal ratio of casualties that you would because of the importance of this particular scenario. And this is already in their mind prior to the two conflicts.
Right.
Okay.
Yes.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.